Paul D. Simmons of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville speaks on abortion, the death of fetal life.
I am glad to be here and to share with you some of the thoughts that I have had about the subject for a number of years. It is a subject of a tremendous amount of interest and also of controversy, and of that we are all aware. There are, however, some issues that I think need to be explored perhaps more critically than we have been accustomed to doing, and to that task I would like to set our minds today. There are a few issues in American life that are more divisive and volatile than the problem of abortion. Since the Supreme Court decision of 1973, abortion has probably been the dominant biomedical issue debated in both public and private. The increasingly shrill opposition to the court decision also promises to make it one of the major issues in the upcoming presidential campaign. Both Republican and Democratic national conventions were tested as to their position on a constitutional amendment prohibiting abortion. The Democrats spawned the aberrant political phenomenon of a single-issue presidential aspirant who took her anti-abortion pitch to the populace via the primary election. The politics of abortion 1976 will undoubtedly create considerable interest in our spectator society, but it would also continue to generate heated debate. The basic issues at stake cluster around the moral questions involved concerning the rightness and wrongness of terminating unwanted pregnancy. The Supreme Court decision has helped to focus the basic problems which must be dealt with in a pluralistic society in deriving an adequate moral stance from which legal and personal decisions may be made. The purpose of this paper is to explore those factors in the present debate from a Christian ethical perspective. A comprehensive treatment which would explore all the nuances of these issues is obviously impossible, though tempting. Even so, it is hoped that a cursory examination of the problems may contribute to an elevation of the level of the debate, and thus perhaps also to a better understanding of divergent perspectives. There are three major problems of considerable importance, it seems to me, which must be dealt with in developing an adequate Christian moral stance regarding abortion. The first is the need for an adequate moral language to speak of the death of the fetus. The need for an adequate moral language to speak of the death of the fetus. One of the major problems in the abortion debate centers in the terminology that is employed with regard to the conceptus. The predominant pattern to this point has been to use the language of Roman Catholic theology, which equates germinating life with person or human being. According to Pope Pius XII, abortion is morally forbidden because it is tantamount to the murder of an innocent person. For him, innocent human life, in whatever condition it is found, is withdrawn from the very first moment of its existence from any direct, deliberate attack. This is a fundamental right of the human person, which is of general value in the Christian conception of life. Hence, as valid for the life still hidden within the womb of the mother as for the life already born and developing outside of her, as much opposed to direct abortion as to the direct killing of the child before, during, and after its birth. While the Catholic consensus is breaking down on this issue, and I'll refer later to Bernard Herring and his book, Medical Ethics, in which he no longer accepts that easy equation of conceptus with human being. This equation of conceptus with human being leads to the assumption that abortion is the murder of a child. Protestant theology has often followed the same logic. Karl Barth argued that no pretext can alter the fact that the whole circle of those concerned is in the strict sense engaged in the killing of human life. For the unborn child is free, is from the very first a child. It is still developing and has no independent life. But it is a man and not a thing, not a mere part of the mother's body. Similarly, Bonhoeffer declared that the destruction of the embryo in the mother's womb is a violation of the right to live which God has bestowed upon this nascent life Now, that is nothing but murder. Since it is fashionable and sometimes persuasive to quote the giants in theology in order to settle thorny issues, such statements have carried considerable weight. To be sure, there is a history of shifting thought concerning the value of the conceptus at various stages in its development. As, for instance, recall the thought of Augustine that placed the value of the conceptus from the time of quickening, the infusion of soul, which he thought was 40 days. That was later changed by Aquinas to 40 days for the male and 80 for the female, a bit of anti-woman bias. Well, the stand may now take the form of arguing from the presence of genotype, which determines personhood, or the presence of rational soul, or simply the presence of cellular division and vital organ differentiation. Basically, however, the perspective may be summarized around several assertions. One, the conceptus is a human being. Two, personhood begins with conception. And three, the willful termination of pregnancy at any stage is murder. To these may be added an obvious fourth assumption, and that is that abortion should be an illegal act punishable by law. The problem with these perspectives is that they often operate as unexamined presuppositions in the rhetoric and literature on the subject. Considerable effort needs to be expended in linguistic analysis, it seems to me, as a way toward effecting a viable vocabulary for ethical discussion on this subject. For instance, what is the proper relation of the language of human to the fetus? Is the fetus a human being or a person? This is, of course, a speculative question. One's answer is determined by other presuppositions. Richard A. McCormick argues, for instance, and he belongs to the Society of Jesus, that a rational soul is present from the moment of conception, and points out that this assertion cannot be proven otherwise if he prefers to believe it to be true. It helps somewhat to point out that neither can he prove his assertion. Such assertions are simply non-verifiable. They are beyond the most sophisticated tests of scientific technology. And so the Hindu believes a cow has a soul while Christians do not. Neither can prove the other wrong except by definitions usually not acceptable to the other. Such deliberations concerning the value or the personhood of the fetus or of the conceptus might be humorous if their consequences were not so serious. Armed with these assumptions and radicalized by the fervor of the true believer, anti-abortionists such as those in the Right to Life movement become vehement and often persuasive in convincing the vulnerable that abortion is murder. Often the questions are posed rhetorically, as if the conclusion is not debatable. As a slide of an aborted fetus is displayed on the screen, the question is posed, shouldn't this murder of innocent children be outlawed? An elementary lesson in linguistic analysis quickly reveals the emotive level at which such statements operate. Now, in moral theology and ethics, we are accustomed to thinking of different levels of moral discourse. Henry David Aiken discerned at least four different levels. The first level he called the evocative expressive or the emotive level. And he says, there, all your moral statement means is I like it or I don't like it. You're stating your preferences and the things that you do not like. The second level is a moral level, he says, in which you give rules for the conclusions that you give. You may cite some biblical passage or give some principle that you hold to be true in every case. The third level he calls the ethical level, at which questions begin to be raised about the rightness of the rules. Why is it right never to lie? Or, if usually one does not lie, is it always wrong to lie? Well, you would raise questions. The fourth level, he says, is the post-ethical, at which one becomes highly philosophical and speculative, and raises the question about why be moral at all? Why is morality important? Well, what I'm saying then is that this rhetoric operates at that first level. There are no reasons given. It is simply an emotive expression about one's preferences, his biases, his likes and dislikes. No reasons are given, for instance, for one, referring to the conceptus as a child. That's simply an assumption. Or two, calling the action murder. Furthermore, nowhere in this rhetoric is there set forth a relation between morals and law. In effect, as so many of our philosophically oriented critics are quick to point out, such statements made by Christians are discredited precisely because they mean nothing beyond the emotional disposition of the speaker. Such tactics against abortion might as legitimately be employed against lung surgery. By displaying a picture of an excised, diseased lung, the speaker could evoke the negative emotions of revulsion common to most laymen at the sight of surgery, and then drive home the question, shouldn't such a disgusting waste of human tissue be outlawed? The emotive factors in such discourse are not its only failings, however. The most serious weakness is in equating person or human being with the earliest stages of conception. The presence of genotype surely presents us with potentiality for development into a human being, but is a cellular division around a particular genotype tantamount to being a person? Surely the concept of person or human being is much more complex. As Charles Hartshorne has noted, an embryo is not a person, but the possibility or the probability of there being a person many months or even years in the future. Obviously, possibilities are important, but to blur the distinction between them, that is, possibilities and actualities, is to darken counsel. To be human is more than bios, since all animals have life. Human signifies capacities of reflective choice, relational responses, and social experience. In short, being human involves considerations regarding quality of life and implies a social existence. While definitions of the essence of the humanum will vary, few theologians would settle for the easy identification of fertilized ovum with human being. This focuses a further problem, and that is the speculative nature of much contemporary rhetoric regarding the presence of life in the conceptus. A great deal of energy is expended in supposed efforts to protect what is called human life. These are based upon declarations about concern for innocent persons. This seems to substitute the abstract for the concrete, however. When the most obvious instance of human life is neglected or abused, namely the woman? Or, what of concern for the product of compulsory pregnancy, the unwanted child? Thanksgiving Day a few years ago, the citizens of Louisville were startled to read that an 8-year-old boy had starved to death on that day. He was a retarded child of a feeble-minded parent who had sought an abortion but was refused when she discovered that she was pregnant for the third time. The defense of the right to life for the fetus should surely include a commitment to the right to be wanted and thus nurtured in love by his parents. Otherwise, the crusader condemns a child to neglect, abuse, institutionalization, or infanticide. Further, society continually pays the cost of such battering as those psychologically misfit for parenthood, created by such abuse, in turn batter their children, and thus perpetuate the problem from generation to generation. This glaring inconsistency in the rhetoric and action of so-called right-to-lifers at times causes the entire abortion debate to appear to be a bogus issues. All the while concern is expressed for the conceptus, There are masses of persons who are neglected while living in pitiable circumstances that are themselves dehumanizing, unjust, inhuman. The prisoner caught in the dehumanization of a criminal justice system in overwhelming need of reform. The children who become the rootless and unloved persons in the halls of juvenile detention. The hungry and starving masses of the world. The migrant worker, the social outcast. All these persons seem to have few fervent advocates. Crusades are waged to assure the passage of every conceptus into the world where people protest this caring, while persisting and focusing on abstractions. Certainly, life is little more than an abstraction of speculative metaphysics in the right to life movement. Just as certainly do we live by grace, else God would call us to immediate account for such neglect of his children. Little did Shakespeare suspect how poor are the players who strut and fret their hour upon the stage. These and other questions need to be raised, therefore, concerning linguistic accuracy in the current debate. Such exercises are necessary if the religious and scientific community is to give any solid guidance in further shaping the Supreme Court's stance regarding abortion. The court refused to rule on the complex issue of the question of personhood and the fetus. Since religious and philosophical views were at variance on this question, how could the law resolve the problem, the court inquired. The nearest it came was to conclude that at the age of viability, the fetus acquired, to use Paul Ramsey's language, the moral equivalent of birth. Undoubtedly, further refinement of the laws regarding late second and third trimester abortions can be expected in the future. Even so, the court has rejected the notion of personhood with regard to the early stages of the conceptus development and thus refused to treat abortion as a criminal matter. This, it seems to me, is an entirely supportable position on philosophical, religious, legal, and moral grounds. This support is based on two fundamental values of the court's decision. First, the court refused to go beyond the legitimate interests of law by legislating a moral or religious issue. It refused to support legislation based upon metaphysical speculation. Thus, it left room for those with religious scruples against abortion not to abort, but refused them the right to impose that sectarian view upon others who do not share their persuasion. Second, the court focused the issue of constitutional rights around persons whose legitimate interests are involved in pregnancy, namely the woman. The woman is the person whose rights have been abridged by restrictive abortion laws. Her interests are at stake, the court declared, and must be protected by both the Fifth and 14th Amendments. The message to churchmen and others in the scientific community now is clear. Now that abortion is legal, the task of education regarding the moral issue in abortion must be dealt with. The forum has been shifted from the courts to the churches and the communities concerning the relation of fetal life to human personhood. Certainly, as Swihart argues, religious ethics must come to grips with the concrete issue of abortion at the point of the origin of life itself. What the churches should seek, however, is not to tell the courts what laws should be passed, but to shape the moral understandings of American society regarding the value of the fetus. For that end, the terminology employed must be as precise as possible, and the tactics which are used must be free from malice. At a minimum, this will require that the language concerning person cannot be easily transferred to that of the fetus. To speak of a conceptus as a person or a human being is to lose any precision in the use of the English language. The biblical witness is clear on this point. Exodus 21, 22 to 25, concerning injury done to a pregnant woman who becomes involved in the fight between males, makes a clear distinction between the life of the woman and that of the unborn. Thus, it also follows that the language of murder with regard to abortion is terribly misleading. Whatever moral gravity may be attached to abortion for any reason certainly would not entail such an ominous judgment as that of homicide. The death of a fetus is not the death of a person. Feticide is not homicide. Women who have resorted to abortion to terminate an unwanted pregnancy should not be made to feel that they are child murderers. This burden of guilt should not be borne by the woman, her attending physician, nor that circle of persons most intimately involved in her decision. The second problem is a search for an adequate client-centered morality. The search for an adequate client-centered morality. A pastoral approach to the problem of abortion is needed, which stresses the needs and responsibility of the client. Debates are usually concerned with legality or rights or protection of fetal life or amendments and due process. Seldom have such moralists permitted caring for the client by acknowledging the liberty of conscience and freedom of responsible choice, which are basic ingredients in the meaning of personhood. The great temptation is to do the greater wrong, to act as the moralistic external judge, ascribing rightness or wrongness to decisions and actions past and present, and proscribing or prescribing actions for the future. The moat hunters are alive and doing well, but leaving behind a wide path strewn with guilt-ridden clients who made the mistake of seeking counsel from well-meaning but misdirected moralists. And might I interject here, one of the concerns that I hear expressed when I deal with pastors and others on the subject is that women are getting abortions without consulting them. There may be good reason for that. And that is, the counsel that they hear may be primarily that of moralism rather than that of caring. The wisdom that they receive is sometimes couched more in judgmental terms than in the parameters of grace and understanding and forgiveness. And so, to stiff-arm our clients from our pulpits, it then should not be surprising to us that they do not seek us out when they are going through some of the real crises of their life. Perhaps we should be reminded that Jesus was sought out by people in crises times. And I suspect that the reason for that is the universal testimony of the New Testament. And that is that what he conveyed through his preachment, through his life, was that of compassion for the troubled, forgiveness for the sinner, a divine act of communicating the incarnate love of God. We as ministers might learn from that. Whatever judgment of wrongdoing that is made must be done with a sense of the tragedy and grief that is involved. It is not the task of either the church or its ministers to tell parishioners what they may or may not do, but to enable them to experience the grace of God in the things they feel they must do. Too often Protestant theology and ethics betray their own foundations and understandings by lapsing into law rather than the grace of the New Testament. As Barth put it, Protestants know and have the word of the free mercy of God, which also ascribes and grants freedom to man. I once participated in a discussion of abortion law reform on a TV talk show in Louisville. Featured were two gynecologists, one Jew and a Roman Catholic, an attorney and two theologians, a Roman Catholic, and allow me to call myself a theologian. A woman was also there who participated in the discussion, because she had received an abortion before the restrictive laws had been set aside by the Supreme Court. However, she sat off camera, refusing to be filmed, and would not be seen any more than necessary, even by members of the panel. During the discussion, she revealed the terrible ostracism that she had experienced by family and friends, and the derision that clergymen and others had heaped upon her in condemning abortion as murder. Even during the panel discussion, heated debate often led to the accusation that women who had had abortions and their attending physicians were child murderers guilty of homicide. This woman's experience should help us to focus two facts. One is the need for an experiential basis to our moral judgments. The other, a need to recognize the place of personal conscience in moral decision making. Since men will never know the threat and terror of childbirth, nor be faced with pregnancy, wanted or otherwise, they are poor arbiters in this debate. I feel a bit awkward in being here today. Even so, men are the power brokers, politically, legally, and morally, when it comes to setting the terms for abortion. Fortunately, the Supreme Court has moved to recognize this inequity confronted at law by women. According to the court, women had been treated as unequals even to the fetus in securing her rights to medical care. The fervid concern for life had failed the most obvious and undebatable instance of life, namely the woman. This concern has been enforced and extended by the court's subsequent ruling that the woman need not have the permission of husband or parents to request abortion. This is a wise and supportable position, since the uniqueness and distinction of the pregnancy is hers alone. As Garrett Hardin pointed out, the final straw that breaks the camel's back does not break the legislator's back nor the theologian's. It breaks hers. In counseling, as it must be at law, the most important considerations in abortion must therefore focus on the woman. Heretofore, the moralistic question has been posed as, what right does a woman have to get an abortion? Increasingly, it is recognized both morally and legally that the question must be posed this way, what right have others to impose an unwanted pregnancy upon a woman? The difference is compulsory pregnancy or pregnancy by choice. Stressing the experiential basis of moral decision making, furthermore, concerning abortion, does not exclude males from the discussion, but it does point to an area of possible blindness. Empathy with the client will become a necessary ingredient in the counseling process. This is caring at a fundamental and highly personal level, but it is not permissiveness based simply on a philosophy of do what you think is morally right. For one of the client's needs is precisely to find out for her what is right, and thus the need for an articulation of moral considerations and alternatives is of paramount importance. The counselor is in a position to help the client accept responsibility for her decisions, not, however, to decide whether or not she has acted responsibly. A client-centered approach to abortion is also consistent with the traditional stress upon the sole competency of the believer, a traditional doctrine among Baptists. Admittedly, this notion, nurtured among Baptists and others, tends toward individualism. It stands against the authoritarian or majority rules orientation of those traditions more concerned with order and conformity to community expectations. In questions concerning religious freedom from political or ecclesiastical tyranny, the doctrine has served well to protect private conscience from group tyranny. It has also served well to safeguard the right to personal insight into scriptural understandings that may challenge prevailing doctrines or dogmas. Thus, the doctrine has been used theologically and ecclesiastically to safeguard extremely important values to to the free church tradition. However, the moral dimensions of soul competency have not been explored sufficiently. Presumably, the fears of moral anarchy or the assumption of a clearer consensus regarding moral issues have functioned to insist upon moral conformity and religious freedom. The question needs to be posed, however, as to whether or not one does not exclude rather than require the other. Concerning abortion, for instance, sufficient attention has not been given to the moral value of the decision born and made by the woman whose pregnancy is in question. The spotlight has been played upon the conceptus as the object of value, rather than the woman as moral actress, living out the demands of moral freedom and responsibility. Reflection as to why this is the case may lead to endless speculation, of course. One possibility, however, is that what is reflected is the anti-woman bias of so much male-dominated theology. Functionally, the doctrine of soul competency has served theology better than morals and men better than women. The universality of moral responsibility, however, includes the universality of moral freedom, for in Christ there is neither male nor female. Barth hints at this in his treatment of the moral question of abortion. For him, the primary moral decision is borne by the woman and her physician. Furthermore, the morality of the decision is not determined by the civil law, because no such law can grasp the fullness of healthy or sick, happy or unhappy, preserved or neglected human life, let alone the freedom of the divine command and the obedience that we owe to it. Precisely because of the fundamental nature of the responsibility involved and the radical obedience that is required, only the woman in question qualifies as the one who may properly respond in freedom and grace. As the pregnancy is hers, so must the moral freedom belong properly to the woman. If the polls are to be believed, a consensus on this matter seems to be developing among Americans in the wake of the Supreme Court decision. This moral understanding is implicit in the theology of soul competency or personal responsibility before God, and for that reason, it is basic to a client-centered ethic. Fortunately, this insight is increasingly to be found even among Roman Catholics. Bernard Herring, in Medical Ethics, openly challenges the papal ability to settle the question of abortion by invoking the doctrine of infallibility. Herring insists on shared experience and co-reflection where moral matters are concerned. For him, this is necessary because, as he says, the final court is the conscience of the physician and or that of the patient, taking fully into account the doctrine of the magisterium and the endeavors of theologians and other ethicists, without which a doctor could not arrive at a thoroughly well-informed decision of conscience. To put that in layman's language, paraphrase a cabinet member who had to apologize for one of his wisest statements, Mr. Earl Butts. He that doesn't play the game doesn't make the rules. A third problem in the abortion debate is the search for the relation of abortion to the command of God. The search for the relation of abortion to the command of God. Morally considered, the problem of abortion must finally be related to what we refer to in ethics and theology as the command of God. Can it be that God may in some cases command the termination of nascent life? Barth answered this question enigmatically from his exploration of the subject using the methodology of paradox. His treatment of abortion was set in the context of what he called the protection of life, where he explored the great summons to halt issued by the command of God forbidding the willful taking of human life. Typically, Barth thundered God's no to any such action. He He emphatically warned of the danger in ever considering the possibility that killing may be either permissible or necessary in certain circumstances. He pointed out that notions about the exceptional case ran the risk of reflecting arbitrary desires or moral self-justification. These temptations, he stressed, must be avoided at all costs. Thus, Bart clearly heard and convincingly declared God's command against killing in any form. However, he then intriguingly added the other side of God's command. Having heard the warning against terminating life, he says, we must be prepared to stand by the truth that at some times or other, perhaps on the far frontier of all other possibilities, it may have to happen in obedience to the commandment that man must be killed by man. This line of reasoning continues in Bart's discussion of abortion, which he accepts as the killing of human life. Even so, he says, the unborn cannot claim to be preserved in all circumstances. The will of God may at times involve the active participation of others in the killing of germinating life, he argues. Where God commands such an action, abortion does not constitute murder. Care must be taken, of course, to spell out the narrow parameters in which abortion may be understood as the command of God. Stress must be placed on the tentative nature of the substantive mood in which it is made. May be understood does not mean is or must be understood. The command of God to abort is a secondary command to that of keeping alive. However, secondary does not mean less important, but more nearly means less frequently given. This is both a religious and a practical understanding. It is practical in that as long as the desires of nature are intact concerning sexual congress, and the protective dynamics of the desirability of children, population growth stability, and symbiotic mother-conceptus relationships are functional, the widespread incidence of conception, that is, obedience to the command to procreate, will be assured. Even so, the secondary command to abort will also be heard by significant numbers of persons. Among these certainly will be women with unwanted pregnancies who hear the command to terminate. Included also will be that coterie of persons who support her decision and empathetically live the experience, her family, the health care team, social scientists, philosophers, ethicists, theologians, and others. Bart was struggling with the problem of the rightness of an action in the exceptional case. He saw clearly that if an act is permitted by God or was related positively to the will of God, the act was morally right. It was not the lesser of two evils, or sinful in any sense. The designation, the command of God, Bart used for this morally proper and correct, even if socially suspect or legally prohibited act. This understanding is important for our current discussions of abortion. While we may not agree with Bart's development of the problem, there can be little argument with his basic assertion that if God wills an act, it is right. Contemporary thought about abortion needs to include the notion that abortion is right under certain circumstances and cease speaking as if every abortion is either a justifiable murder or a tragic concession to necessity. To be sure, the tension between the command to procreate and the command to terminate must be maintained. However, the command to procreate is much more easily heard than the command to terminate. The drive to sexual congress is a powerful urge that has ensured the proliferation of the species. Theologically, this natural urge has been interpreted as the command of God to be fruitful and multiply and fill up the earth. Understandably, the religious focus for centuries in the life of the people of God was upon procreation. There was a need for people.
This concludes Dr. Simmons' address.